very much for the opportunity to speak. So let me start with a physical slide. And what's pictured here are some different kinds of photonic structures, three-dimensional, two-dimensional, and one-dimensional structures. Photonic structures are heterogeneous media through which we propagate light. And why do we study these? Well, there's been a recognition that one can influence the in very, very subtle and important ways, the propagation of waves through through media by introducing inhomogeneities, either stacking two different kinds of materials or doing more complicated things. And the applications of propagation through heterogeneous nonlinear media of optical waves has there are important applications in communications and in more exotic things. And communications, for example, one's interested in shaping optical pulses, or a longer-term goal is to eliminate things like the electrical interface between electrical components and optical components by just having everything optical. So one seeks media with many degrees of freedom that one can tune to basically process light. And then there are applications also to various fields of atomic physics, for example, making elements for future quantum computers, or for manipulating such exotic states of matter as Bose-Einstein condensates. So just an overview of what my two talks are going to be on. The first talk today, I'll talk about nonlinear propagation in inhomogeneous media, and the theme is going to be different kinds of resonances. So the three kinds of resonances that will come up in this talk are the following. We'll have some kind of a pulse. This is your initial data, say, for a partial differential equation. It'll be a slowly varying envelope of something rapidly oscillatory. There is a wavelength, a carrier wavelength, underneath the envelope. And this wave will interact with a periodic structure, a periodic medium. And if there's a suitable Bragg resonance in the media, then we'll see that there's a strong coupling of backward and forward wave fields. And so something propagating in the forward direction will immediately generate propagation in the backward direction. And these things will interact nonlinearly. So that's one kind of resonant interaction. That's just an interaction of plane waves. The next thing we'll do is we'll take the periodic structure and we'll introduce some kind of a localized defect. So that's some spatially localized deviation from periodicity. And the reason for that is to try and see if we can get light to actually stand still in a defect. So light is propagating along at some speed. A pulse of light is propagating at some speed in a heterogeneous medium, a periodic structure, and then it encounters some deviation from periodicity, and the idea is to try and get it trapped. How do we trap light? Well, what we want to do is transfer the energy from this pulse to some natural modes, natural beating modes of the medium, sometimes called defect modes. That's another kind of resonant energy resonance, and that's resonance of a discrete nonlinear, of two different kinds of nonlinear bound states, a propagating nonlinear bound state in a symmetric media where there's some kind of translation symmetry transferred to some kind of a pinned defect state. And then finally, once the energy is deposited in this medium, you can study the large time dynamics of the system. So there's a pulse, it's sitting in the medium. The defect can have multiple states in it, right? Just like a drum head can vibrate with different modes, so there could be different nonlinear states. And if you wait long enough, then one sees in these problems that typically, for generic initial conditions, energy wants to radiate out of the excited states and reside asymptotically in the ground state. And that's a third kind of resonance. This resonance is a resonance of nonlinear bound states with radiation modes. So we'll encounter all three of those. Let's talk. The second talk will be rather different. Instead of looking at propagation and focusing on the longitudinal propagation, what we'll do is we'll slice a waveguide perpendicular to the direction of propagation. So this is going to be the cross section of say an optical fiber waveguide or some other structure, and we're interested in how well these structures confine energy. So if I shoot light down in that red spot, then what will happen is if I have some heterogeneous structure, light will possibly radiate out, and it'll radiate out either, well, because of specific characteristics, the geometry over here and the index contrast, or it could radiate out because of some kind of defects along the direction of propagation. In the latter case, there's a phenomena of diffusion of energy among the various modes. I'll talk about that next time. And then I want to talk about also the homogenization theory of scattering resonances, where we'll exploit the rapidly varying character of the transverse structure in order to say some rather precise things about scattering resonances. Okay, I'll actually show next time some specific pictures, but most of these waveguides, there's a microstructure region which is concentrated at the center, and then there's a pretty much a homogeneous part that's outside. Okay, all right. A well-known example is a truncated hexagonal lattice of holes, which is concentrated, say, in a 10 micron radius area, and then out to 120 microns might be homogeneous. Yeah. Right. Okay. So today's topic, nonlinear propagation in inhomogeneous media, and in particular what happens in periodic structures or periodic structures with defects, and these are collaborators on various aspects of this work. Dick Slusher from Bell Labs, an experimentalist, Roy Goodman now at NJIT, Phil Holmes at Princeton, Avi Sofer at Rutgers, Edward Kerr at Chicago, and Russell Jackson at Boston University. Here's the outline. I'll first describe physically and then give the mathematics of a resonant interaction of a high-intensity light pulse with a periodic structure. We'll see that because of this resonance, the so-called Bragg resonance in the medium, the medium is highly dispersive, and then balanced with nonlinear effects in the medium, one has soliton-like states, which are rather different from the solitons that propagate, say, in a homogeneous optical fiber that Bill Kath will talk about in his lectures. So we have soliton-like states, and we're interested in the control problem of designing defects in a periodic structure so as to trap soliton-like pulses. The interest in that would be for things like optical storage, making optical buffers. So we have to have some kind of a model. We come up with a model of an optical trap and then do numerical simulations and also some finite dimensional modeling, and then talk about this phenomena that was the last type resonance that I mentioned, which is resonance of discrete modes with radiation modes, where we can obtain an understanding of the asymptotic distribution of trapped energy in a defect. All right, so this is a cartoon of experiments that were done some years ago by Dick Slusher at Bell Labs, Ben Eggleton, who was then a postdoc, and then a group in the UK as well, in a different system. This is a sideways slice of an optical fiber. Okay, so this is in bare optical fiber, you just have an outer cladding with refractive index N2 and an inner core with refractive index N1. Forget about the green stripes for a moment. when N1 is larger than N2, light is guided, think of rays bouncing along here, by the principle of total internal reflection. What we do here is we introduce a periodic structure. So the refractive index, well, squared here, behaves like the cosine, has some background, and then a periodic function of z. And then, taking into account nonlinear effects, we have a term here, E squared. So E is the electric field, and the refractive index is higher in regions where the field is more intense. Okay. The core of the fiber is about 5 microns, 10 to the minus 6 meters is a micron. The entire width of the fiber is about 125 microns. The size of the experiment is just about 5 centimeters. Okay. So unlike soliton propagation in communication fiber, which happens over tens and tens of kilometers, this is a very, very small experiment, small in physical dimensions experiment, but it's very, very high power. This periodic structure, when you propagate at the Bragg resonance that I'll explain in a second, is a very, very highly dispersive structure. So in order to balance dispersion and nonlinearity over such a small distance, you have to propagate at very, very high powers. So these powers are like gigawatts per centimeter squared, in contrast to communication fiber, which is on the order of milliwatts per centimeter squared. Okay. So here's the light pulse. It's a slowly varying envelope of something highly oscillatory, and the carrier wavelength, about 1.5 microns, is taken to be about twice the medium periodicity. So that's a resonant situation, and so it's we'll see what the consequences of that are in a second. There it is, the Bragg resonance, and it's a very highly dispersive regime, as we'll see. So the electric field. So this optical fiber that I drew on the previous slide has a single transverse mode. So all of the energy is in a single transverse mode, and so we could just think of the electric field as varying only with z and t. Okay. The electric field satisfies a nonlinear Maxwell-like equation. This is a nonlinear wave equation with periodic coefficients and with nonlinearity coming here. So this is E cubed sub t, and this is cosine of z times e. Okay? So that's a nonlinear periodic wave equation. And the initial conditions for it are of the sort that I drew on the previous slide. It's wave packet initial conditions. So epsilon is a small number, and so a is a localized function. So this is a slowly varying envelope of something highly oscillatory. And the 2k over here and the k over here means that I've prepared the situation so that I'm at the Bragg resonance. So the medium period is 2 pi over 2k or pi over k, and the carrier wavelength is just 2 pi over k, so the wavelength is twice the medium periodicity. And then the last thing, in order to set things up, is that I want nonlinearity to balance with the effects of periodicity, and so I take the electric field to be of order square root of epsilon so that these terms balance. Okay. So let's see what the effects of that are. So this Bragg resonance gives a strong coupling of backward and forward waves. Let's see how. If I just consider the linear part of the equation, let me look at a forward-going wave. I have E plus E to the ikz minus omega t. I feed it into the equation. So E multiplies the cosine. The cosine gives you a plus 2 ikx and a minus 2 ikx, and I just add the frequencies, and I see I generate a backward-going wave. So a forward wave generates a backward-going wave through this term, and then similarly, a backward wave generates a forward wave. Just the arithmetic of plane waves. So now add in nonlinearity. So solve this nonlinear PDE with the initial conditions that I've shown. And what this is at different times the solution to the nonlinear wave equation with periodic coefficients. What I'm not showing here are about 80 oscillations underneath the envelope. Okay, so this is a solution of the nonlinear wave equation. This is the envelope of the solution. There are about 80 oscillations. In practice, in the physical setup that I described earlier, the number of oscillations under the character are on the order of tens of thousands. So the situation really begs for an envelope description. This is how this is how the full PDE behaves, though. If you start with slowly varying envelope of an oscillatory wave, what you see is it begins to propagate, and notice that the propagation is not monotonic. Okay, a typical nonlinear Schrödinger soliton would just propagate at some constant speed to the right, but what's happening here is that you have some superposition of backward and forward going waves. So you have the energy of sloshing back and forth, but in this particular situation, it's moving, there's a net motion to the right, but it's not a monotonic motion. So this is a superposition of backward and forward going waves. But notice that it's not dispersing. If I turn the nonlinear terms off, then this would just disperse to zero. It would slosh back and forth, but then the amplitude would reduce and it would spread as well, as you typically get in dispersive problems. So what's the envelope description? So here is the initial condition. Here is the periodic medium, and this is the scaling that I described already. You could construct solutions of this type. Formal multiscale analysis gives rise to these nonlinear coupled mode equations, which are in many ways like the nonlinear Schrödinger equation and nonlinear dispersive equations, but they're a bit more like the Dirac equation. They're first order finite propagation speed equations. E plus is the slowly varying envelope of the forward wave. E minus is the slowly varying envelope of the backward wave. The periodicity is the effective periodicity on the time scales of interest is right over here. If kappa is equal to zero, that corresponds to turning the cosine term off. Okay, and then E plus non-zero and E minus equal to zero would not generate a backward going wave. But if I have the periodic structure, E plus generates an E minus, and E minus generates an E plus. Okay. There is a special case of this equation where I kill off the E plus, this E plus squared term and this E minus squared term. These are the so-called self-phase modulation terms. That actually gives one the massive, what's called a massive tiering model, going back to the late 1950s. Which that turns out to be an integrable system. This system, however, is not integrable. Gamma is a constant that you could compute. It comes from the multiscale analysis. It's obtained by some inner products function. So there's some kind of you plug this into the equation, you get an error term. You want the error to be small for times of order 1 over epsilon. It's a non-resonance condition, and the gamma is just a constant that falls in. No, gamma is of order 1 over here. I've arranged things. I've arranged the equation so that the leading order behavior sits right there. Or everything is of order 1 here. Okay. So the epsilons are there. There's the amplitude. Right. So I scaled things so that everything balances nicely. So this is a rigorous first term in an asymptotic expansion. And there's a theorem that we proved a while ago, which says, this is with Roy Goodman and Phil Holmes, that says that for an appropriate nonlinear Maxwell model, we're able to show rigorously that nonlinear coupled mode equations govern. Okay. This is for times of order 1 over epsilon. Just a comment. I want to point out in these talks what are some interesting mathematical issues that I don't think are well understood that might be of interest to investigate. You can ask, well, what happens to the envelope approximation? How does it break down? So for very, very long times, the envelope description does a very, very good job, but then there is eventually some kind of a departure, okay, on very, very long time scales. Here it was 4,000, but trust me, that's a very, very long time scale in the units that we were using. There's some kind of a steepening, some kind of an envelope shock begins to develop. And since it's a dispersive system, as with when you have shock-like behavior, you see oscillations being generated as well. So there's some kind of a dispersive tail phenomena that occurs on large timescales. One of the things that we saw in the numerics, actually, is that the envelope approximation seemed to work for locating the where the energy was on much longer timescales than is suggested by the times of order 1 over epsilon estimate of the theory, of the theorem. Okay, so there's a question that one can ask: is there some weaker norms where with respect to which one has one can prove the validity of this approximation? You see, the way things break down is they break down because there's the way phases seem to propagate on very, very large timescales. So it could be that there might be some cruder norms, some coarser norms with respect to which one can show that the energy is well captured on much longer timescales. What timescale? I don't know. There's a question there. That's on to the minus two, but I don't know. I can't no, all bets are off there, but that would be wonderful. Okay. Okay. Well, so one has these nonlinear coupled mode equations, which govern on at least on a certain time scale, and you could look at their the linearization about zero, and you get plane wave solutions. And here's the dispersive character of the equation coming in. You see that there is some non-trivial dispersion relation. In fact, this is just the Klein-Gordon dispersion relation. If you drop the semilinear, if you drop the nonlinear terms in these coupled mode equations, then what you observe is that each component, E plus and E minus, satisfies the linear Klein-Gordon equation, and the mass term is the kappa, which was the coupling from the periodic structure. There is the dispersion relation. There are two branches, and there is a gap in the middle. And all this is, this should not be surprising. If you go back to the original wave equation, the linear problem is described entirely in terms of Hill's equation, right, or Mathieu's equation for the cosine potential. And that is known to have infinitely many gaps, and all the multiscale analysis is doing is it's blowing up the fundamental gap in the spectrum. Okay. Experimentally, this is what Ben Eggleton and company did. They sent light in a periodic structure at different wavelengths, and they observe, and you look at transmission as a function of wavelength. And if you're outside the gaps, waves can propagate, and if you're inside the gaps, they can't propagate. And so what an experimentalist does is measures the gap width and then divides by 2 and then hands that number to the theorist to put into his model. Right? So if you want to calibrate experiment to theory, that's how you would do it. All right. So this is then a gap in the spectrum. So this is the continuous spectrum. Some people like to draw it like that. Okay, so there's the continuous spectrum. If I make things self-adjoint, this is the continuous spectrum, and this is a gap in the spectrum. And then it turns out that there are solitons. Okay, for these nonlinear coupled mode equations, for each frequency in the gap, there is a finite energy nonlinear bound state. That's a pair of functions, E plus of Z and E minus of Z, square integrable, which satisfies the coupled mode equations. Okay. And that's how they look. Okay. In this regime, this is the so-called nonlinear Schrödinger limit. And up here, they actually have algebraic decay there as you approach this end of the gap. So this is the vertical axis is just the energy. It's just the L2 norm of the state, the L2 norm of the soliton, but it's a vector soliton here because there are two components, E plus and E minus. This is the radiation mode. So this is like the nonlinear Schrödinger picture, where you get bifurcation from the endpoint to the continuous spectrum. Okay. And PBG stands for the words photonic band gap. That's how. That's the term. How do you decide which band edge? Right, right. It's the curvature of the dispersion relation. Okay, so this is, you see, you don't have solitons up there. You would have dark solitons. But it's where the curvature of the dispersion relation is positive that you have the focusing nonlinearity giving you a soliton. And then you just follow your nose or follow the branch and see where it goes. I don't know of any here. You know what? Maybe for the integrable problem, you know, there are multi-soliton states. I don't know where those would fit in. But, yeah. I should say that. Whoa! I keep just you, by the end of the day. I'm going to fall by the end of the day. Right. Off the band edge. Right. Yeah, right. The band. Okay. There is a Hamiltonian structure underlying all of this, and these gap solitons, if omega is the frequency. Okay, these gap solitons can be seen as critical points of Hamiltonian minus omega times the L2 norm, that functional there. But the gap solitons are not constrained. They're not constrained minimizers. Okay, they're saddle points of infinite index, and so the nonlinear stability theory of these guys is completely open. In fact, there is some work showing that there are linear instabilities up here, linear oscillatory instabilities. I believe that one has nonlinear stability down here, but I don't think there's a proof of it. Okay. So the idea of using convexity methods failed, because the soliton, like in, say, the water wave problem and many other problems, is a critical point of infinite index. That's another interesting question. For the special case of these cubic nonlinearities that you saw, it's possible to write down formulas for the gap soliton, and that was done. Well, actually, going back to the work of Turing and then Kaup and Newell for the massive Turing model, but then more recently Christodoulidis and Joseph and Aceves and Wadnitz wrote down. Multi-parameter families of gap solitons. They have a Sech-like profile, and then there's something like a Lorentz invariance. It's actually only a Lorentz invariance in the case of the massive Turing model. So here are these gap solitons, and that's the frequency that lives in the gap between minus kappa and kappa, cosine delta varies between minus 1 and 1. Of interest to experimentalists is what happens when you propagate these type pulses, or you excite them in periodic structures and propagate them. And Eggleton, Slusher, and then Broderick et al. Were able to observe gap solitons going at about half the speed of light. Okay. So again, in contrast to what happens in standard optical fiber, where you have a uniform medium where the pulses propagate at the speed of light of glass, here you have this highly dispersive structure. The periodic structure behaves like an array of semi-transparent mirrors, and the collective pulse of light will propagate at speeds which can vary, actually, in theory, between zero and the speed of light. Okay, so this is quite exciting to an experimentalist because it's a challenging project to try and see if you could actually stop a light pulse. And for Slusher, the interesting application was to create optical buffers, or demonstrate the principle of an optical buffer. Okay. So to summarize, gap solitons are nonlinear coherent structures which stably propagate in homogeneous periodic media, at least in certain parameter regimes. They, in principle, exist at any speed between zero and the speed of light. Experiments show them at about half the speed of light. And the question is, can a moving gap soliton be trapped? And the strategy that we use to attack this is by introducing designer defects in the periodic structure, again, with a view towards coming up with ideas for optical storage and buffering of bits. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
That way I get you to move right
away. Okay. All right. Try to do that. Well, now I have to find where I was. Okay. So here's a way to approach the problem of trapping a gap soliton. Let's do the following. Let's take a periodic structure which is exactly periodic at minus infinity and plus infinity, but create some localized deviation. And I seem to have left out a slide with the structure, but let's think of now of n squared of z and E, that's the refractive index squared, as having a part which is, say, a background, say, an average, plus a mean part, an average part, which is slowly varying, plus a modulated cosine. Okay. And now, and then there's the nonlinear term. Okay, so that's okay. So this is the old formula for the refractive index. Only now I'm allowing the parameters in that to vary very slowly. Okay, so this is some slow modulation of the average as well as the first harmonic of the refractive index profile, as well as the phase. And these are knobs that an experimentalist can turn. You prescribe a W, a kappa, and a phi, and an experimentalist can create a periodic structure with those parameters. Okay. Within reason. Well, depending on the material system, remarkably within reason. So, for example, in glass, very, very well, but in more exotic materials, less so. Okay. So given a W, a kappa, and a phi, okay, that's a periodic structure, and then you plug that into, so now that kappa is varying with, is slowly varying now, so that shows up over here, and then there's another parametric function, V, that's inherited from this derivation here. The point is that you can derive a modified nonlinear coupled mode system where kappa and V are slowly varying functions which are inherited, which are constructible from the functions which define the periodic structure. Okay, so now instead of having something like the nonlinear Schrödinger equation with constant coefficients, spatially translation invariant coefficients, now we have something like the nonlinear Schrödinger equation with variable coefficients, or like the nonlinear Dirac equation with variable coefficients. Okay. The first thing to think about would be what are the defect modes of the system? That would be like what happens if I turn off the nonlinear terms. What are the natural modes of the defect? Right? If I turn down the nonlinearity, this over here tells me what the characteristics of this structure are. What are the natural modes of vibration there? Okay. So this slide just shows you examples of such modes. But the point is that you have this Dirac-like system with potentials gives rise to localized states. Okay. And it can be shown by either variational methods or just the implicit function theorem that one has bifurcation from those defect modes of one gets nonlinear defect states. In contrast to the In contrast to the gap solitons, these states, which bifurcate from these energies in the gap, are pinned. They're localized at the defect site. So this picture over here, this curve over here, the upper curve, corresponds to the periodic structure at plus or minus infinity. Okay? You have this family of gap solitons, and those are going to be guys that are coming in from infinity, and they're going to interact with nonlinear defect modes. So here's what numerical simulations show. So these are simulations of these equations with, well, actually I could take the true equations even by using both slides. Okay. Oh. Thanks, Sergei. So solve these equations with some local, well, with a gap soliton initial condition at infinity. At infinity, these kappa and v are a constant, are constants, and so you have a nice propagating pulse. But then when that pulse arrives at z equal to zero, where the defect is concentrated, then it will interact in some way. So for example, you can get reflection, you can get transmission. Or you can get capture. And this is the sort of behavior that we were interested in, is seeing how to fashion a defect, how to, given a pulse with given pulse parameters, how to fashion a defect that will trap the energy. And then you could look very carefully and spectrally analyze the trapped energy, and then what one can observe is that asymptotically things settle down to the ground state of the system. That was that ladder picture that I described in the overview slide. So just a general remark, an obvious remark, is that soliton defect interactions are marked by a complex exchange of energy between the coherent pulse and the modes of the defect. And the modes of the defect mean those nonlinear defect modes of this form that we found, which bifurcate from the linear defect modes. There are a couple of cases that you can see by superposing bifurcation diagrams. Here, remember, was the bifurcation diagram of the gap soliton. Okay. So this said that at every energy in the photonic band gap, there was a soliton of that frequency. And if I introduce a localized defect, then there's in this particular case, there's only one defect mode in the system. And so imagine sending in a gap soliton of this frequency. A gap soliton of this frequency doesn't have any, can't find a nonlinear defect mode which has the same frequency with which to resonate. So you'd expect in such an instance that you might get reflection or transmission. In this case, however, a nonlinear defect mode does have a partner. An incoming gap soliton of this frequency does have a partner with that same resonance, and so there's a chance of exchanging energy from the incoming defect mode to the incoming gap soliton to the trapped defect mode. So that picture is a bit oversimplified. That's not true, but that's something that we investigated, and it turns out to actually work in a number of instances. So I'll just show you a couple of slides of that type. So when in the resonant picture, when there are incoming gap solitons, in the non-resonant picture, when you have incoming gap soliton, incoming gap soliton with no nonlinear defect mode with which to resonate, you had, in this case, reflection. This is the center of mass of the pulse as a function of time, reaches the defect and then bounces backward. This is the amount of energy, and you see there's no amount of energy in the localized defect mode in the soliton. We see there's very little energy transfer. And in the resonant case, we see that there's a nearly complete energy transfer. So here the soliton is getting trapped, and the the local nonlinear localized mode is getting awakened and eventually captures the energy. And there's an energy difference which goes off to radiation. So that's something we'd like to understand better. And here's a simple model to try and get at it. Okay. So think of these next few slides as one large open analytical problem for which there's a lot of numerical and formal analytical evidence. Okay. So delta, that's a delta function. Now delta function at zero. Okay. So why delta function at zero? Well, you know, just as if I let gamma equal to zero, that's the cubic nonlinear Schrodinger equation, it has solitons. It turns out I could write down a soliton for this equation. I just solve the equation exactly to the left by a hyperbolic secant. I solve it to the right by a hyperbolic secant, and then I just match across the delta function, just as you would do in a linear quantum problem. It's the defect. Think of it as just the extreme case of a potential well. So this is an attractive delta function defect. So this is meant to give intuition for what would happen to something of some anything localized. Okay. It's just that here we could actually have an explicit analytical solution. Okay. And so notice that. As I vary the parameter A, then that's a parameter along the bifurcation curve and of defect modes. And there you have it. Okay. So this is this over here is continuous spectrum going out to plus infinity. Here are the solitons in the absence of any kind of delta function defect. And in the presence of that delta function defect, there's bifurcation from a simple eigenvalue of minus the second derivative minus the delta function times gamma. All right. And there are non-resonant and resonant situations. So here we fire in a soliton pulse from minus infinity at a frequency which doesn't have some corresponding defect mode to which it can transfer its energy. And in this case, we send in a soliton from minus infinity which does have a partner to which it can transfer its energy. Okay. So we're interested in seeing whether we can come up with an explanation for regimes of trapping in different situations. When can you trap an optical pulse? When can you not trap? When can you do you trap a nonlinear Schrodinger soliton? When do you not? Okay. So a simple approach is used going back 30, 40 years is a method of collective coordinates. So this is a formal calculation, an uncontrolled it's an uncontrolled approximation to the solution, which will do. And in some cases, over the years, people have learned how to make these things rigorous. So let's give it a try here. We think of the solution as being made up of a soliton and a defect mode, with parameters eta, v, phi, a, which vary with time. The system is a Lagrangian system. This is the Lagrangian of the PDE. Take this and plug it into the equation, okay, and integrate over the spatial variables, and then integrate over, this should actually be integral over space and time. And then you're left with an effective Lagrangian in the slow variables alone. And here I'm neglecting terms which look oscillatory. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. So here's an effective Lagrangian. And then one could go ahead and compute the Euler-Lagrange equations and study what happens to trajectories. And I'm not going to go into this in detail. We've done some analysis of these systems of ODEs which emerge in this fashion. But Let's just say that the behavior is complicated. It's a like, as you would expect in a higher degree of freedom Hamiltonian system. In the resonance regime, in the regime where we expect capture and resonance, the following happens. What I've pictured here is the horizontal axis is the input velocity of the soliton, and the vertical axis is the outgoing velocity. If I'm going at sufficiently high speeds, then everything gets through. Okay. So a positive outgoing velocity means that it gets through the defect. A negative outgoing velocity means that it gets reflected. So we see there's a regime of basically these are like resonance windows, where you get sometimes a reflection and sometimes transmission, and it's only on a very, very thin set that you actually get capture. Now, this is remember, this is the effective Lagrangian whose dynamics we're studying now, right? This is a finite dimensional system, since we're looking at a Hamiltonian system, the set of initial conditions for which you can get capture by a Poincaré recurrence type argument is only measure zero. So let me just show you in a contrast in another problem. This is the problem of trapping of kinks. What we have. So here, this comes from, this is a phase diagram of outgoing versus incoming velocity for an incoming kink on a defect, as predicted by some collective coordinate equations. And this system over here is these collective coordinate equations corrected by the inclusion of radiation damping effects. You see, the ansatz that we used to obtain these collective coordinate equations were depended only on a finite number of parameters, the intrinsic parameters of the soliton and the defect mode. However, if you include radiation modes, then it's possible to calculate the first term due to coupling to the continuous spectral modes, and one gets such nonlinear damping terms. What that leads to is that very, very thin, almost fractal-like behavior being fattened into positive measure capture. Okay. So this is all a formal calculation and numerical experiments, and I think a great open problem is to be able to say something rigorous about this. Okay. Just to summarize it, limitations of finite dimensional model in describing capture. We start with a finite dimensional Hamiltonian volume preserving phase flow, and one can prove that the set of incoming solitons which are captured for such models has measure zero. On the other hand, you observe for the PDE that you get capture plenty of time, right? You wouldn't be able to observe measure zero capture. Why is this capture for the full infinite dimensional PDE robust? Well, it's robust because of coupling to a radiation field, which gives you an effective damping, and what that does is it fattens the domains of attraction, the domains of capture. So one has to learn in a systematic way how to correct these finite dimensional Hamiltonian description by inclusion of radiation damping corrections. The next thing I'll talk about is an example where one can do this, and that's this phenomena of selection of the ground state. So here we talked about the generation of solitons, which came from the resonant-induced dispersion balanced with nonlinearity. We talked about resonant transfer of energy into the defect modes, nonlinear defect modes of the problem, and now, once the energy is trapped, there's some competition for the energy among the different defect modes, nonlinear defect modes that live there, and the ground state is what wins out. So in this latter part, I'll talk about nonlinear Schrödinger equation with a potential. So the potential is the source of the defect modes. Okay. Linear eigenstates of the linear eigenmodes deform into nonlinear eigenmodes. And, well, I've talked plenty about optical applications today, but there are some earlier ones in the plasma context, going back to a joint work with Harvey Rose in the late 80s. And there's a lot of recent work on this problem as well in the context of Bose-Einstein condensation, where the V of X is some kind of a magnetic trap for a large collective of bosonic particles. There's a lot of work on this equation, related work, and these are a number of the authors: Buslav Perlman, Buslav Sulem, Kukanya, Frölich, Tsai Yao, Kukanya, Kier, and Pelanovsky have a paper recently. All right. So here's a summary of this work. We take the nonlinear Schrödinger equation with the potential, and let's assume that the potential, now we're talking about the linear problem, it has only two bound states. So there's two linearly independent localized solutions of the for the Hamiltonian minus Laplacian plus V. So there are the eigenstates, two negative eigenstates, and continuous spectrum from 0 to infinity. We take initial conditions which are arbitrary and localized. And if you propagate that for the nonlinear for the linear problem, just for the linear Schrödinger equation, this e to the minus iht on a localized initial condition, then we know that the general behavior is some quasi-periodic oscillation plus a piece that decays in L infinity. N is the spatial dimension. So there's some asymptotic resolution, asymptotic decomposition into a quasi-periodic piece, and then radiative decay. What happens to the nonlinear problem? Well, one can proceed in the same way. The first step is to look for nonlinear bound states. Now they solve a nonlinear elliptic equation, and these there are such bound states. They bifurcate at zero amplitude from the states of the linear problem. So this is the picture if lambda is negative. So then you have an attractive potential and attractive nonlinear potential, and the bound states bend that way. This is any norm, say the L2 norm. Okay. And the energies also deform with amplitude. Alpha zero is a parameter along the ground state curve, and alpha one is a parameter which describes where you are along the excited state curve. Alpha is complex. It has an amplitude which gives you the distance, but there's actually a circle there because alpha can have a phase as well. So you think of alpha as being two parameters. There's an interesting case that I considered recently with Russell Jackson, actually motivated by work of Frölich and Frölich and co-workers. Consider the case where V of X is not just the standard single potential well, but say a double well. Then in this case of delta functions, double delta function, one can analyze this problem very, very explicitly. What Frölich and co-workers proved was that if you take an L2, if you look at large enough total particle number, that is large enough L2 norm, then the ground state of the system doesn't reflect the symmetry of the double well. The ground state of the system at very, very high L2 norms is concentrated in the left well or in the right well, but not in both. The ground state of the linear problem is well known to be concentrated, to have a bimodal distribution. I should have drawn it. It has a bump over each of the wells. That's so-called symmetric state. But what Frohlich and company prove is that there is a symmetry breaking at sufficiently high L2 norms. What we do in this model is we're able to analyze it entirely at all amplitudes. We're able to follow the symmetry breaking transition. And what we prove is that the ground state at small energies is symmetric and is nonlinearly stable. And once you get to a critical value of the L2 norm, there's a symmetry breaking bifurcation, and it's the asymmetric state, that is a state which is concentrated on one well or the other well, but not both, which becomes stable. Okay. So that's a related problem of interest, a particular set of nonlinear bound states. Okay. And what we're interested in when lambda is not equal to zero is, well, we have two nonlinear bound states. There's no superposition principle. So what happens? How does the solution of NLS resolve as t goes to infinity? And how do the nonlinear bound states, psi alpha 0, psi alpha 1, participate in the dynamics? Here is the result. So, nonlinear Schrodinger equation with a potential, two bound states. We look at weak nonlinearity. There's a resonance condition, sometimes called the Fermi-Golden rule, or really a nonlinear analog of the Fermi-Golden rule. This is a statement about resonance of the bound states with the continuous spectrum. So this is really, this is saying that there is a resonance, and it's actually a non-trivial one. There is a strong coupling. And so this is actually something which is generically true. The positivity of it is generically true. It's always non-negative, but generically it's strictly positive. We have that asymptotically the solution asymptotically the solution relaxes to a nonlinear bound state where either you have a nonlinear ground state or a nonlinear excited state, but it's the nonlinear ground state asymptotics that's generic. Okay. Tsai and Yao were able to construct examples where you obtain the non-generic behavior of the excited state, but the generic behavior is J equal to zero. Asymptotically, you get a nonlinear ground state. And notice that this is in three dimensions, so this is a very, very slow decay rate, and this is controlled by some finite dimensional normal form. The standard decay rate in low energy scattering with no bound states would be p to the minus 3/2 in three dimensions. Not here. Let me just show one slide indicating the behavior. There are really three timescales on which to consider this problem. The key after a careful analysis and of normal form type, coupled to estimates, coupled to dispersive estimates, is the key can be reduced to this picture. If I look at the amount of power, the amount of energy in the ground state, and the amount of energy in the excited state, there's a dynamical system, a finite dimensional dynamical system that governs this. It's a finite dimensional dynamical system which is weakly coupled to the radiative behavior. Okay. If I look at this finite dimensional system, then one can analyze it and see behaviors on different timescales. First, there is an initial layer where you can say actually very, very little. In this case, the ground state can actually be very small and the excited state can dominate it. Then there's except in non-generic situations where the asymptotics is the excited state, there will be a turnaround time where the ground state will grow relative to the excited state. This one can establish by a Lyapunov-type argument based on this ODE system. And then eventually, there is a time when the ground state is dominant. And in this regime, one sees asymptotic collapse onto the ground state, which follows from a phase portrait analysis of this. So it's these three timescales one has to consider, and so there is some normal form type analysis coupled with a lot of dispersive estimates. Okay. So I'll stop there.
Thank you.